Welcome to Season 2 of Disability Bandwidth,
a show where we talk with experts in disability about their journey, life, and inspiration.
I'm Sam Pru.
And I'm Nikki Nolan.
Let's get started.
Would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. My name is Angie Rajani. I am wearing a black beanie with pastel-colored mushrooms of different varieties. It's a little bit chilly, which is why I'm wearing a hat inside. I would describe my skin as like a darker caramel. I have black hair, which is about shoulder, a little bit beyond shoulder length. It's long and kind of wavy. I have black eyebrows. My glasses are round and black. I have a septum piercing. I am not wearing any makeup at the present moment. And I have a blue cardigan with a blue knit top inside. So my day role is I work at the Government of Canada, at the Canadian Human Rights Commission, as a web accessibility technical advisor. But I'm going to focus on what my non-day job is, which is the role and the consulting I continue to do outside, which gave me the day job that I have. So I am an inclusive design strategist. I came from the School of Digital Accessibility, but my roles have given me opportunities to weigh in on topics like inclusive recruiting, employment, DEI, procurement of software, hardware, technology, training. So now I consider myself someone who can operate in, I would say, inclusive design strategy from a corporate perspective, while still having the technical skills to support developers and designers with code or content changes, as well as speak to HR on, like, you know, how is it that we dismantle, you know, time tests, or how do we make sure that we're reaching the right populations so that everyone can apply for roles?
Wow.
Seems so like cool. You've had the opportunity to work in both government and corporate. And we hear a lot of things about, like, oh, government is slow and hard, and oh, corporate only cares about profit. And, like, I'm interested, what do you find to be the differences in the two environments, and which do you think is maybe more challenging?
So for me, I think each one has its own challenges. I think entering government, there are certain structures that you will have to navigate. And I understand, you know, if we think about a government not being a profit producing place, and not that like our government is or isn't, it's just, where do the funds go, right? It's people's taxpayer dollars, or, you know, they're paying for products and services, and that's where that money goes. So being able to allot that money fairly across however many branches, departments, for me, I think it's just getting people trained up and people fully aware and understanding that it's like it's happening. It just might take longer because of the amount of resources that we have and who we're able to recruit, just because I know that the government recruitment process just takes a little bit longer, because if we think about being risk averse, right, you'd want to make sure that you hire the right people with the right skills and that they'd be able to hit the ground running or what have you. Whereas in corporate, I've noticed that there's a lot more opportunities to move around and learn digital accessibility on the job. I've noticed that there's a general culture towards encouraging training or people to make it part of their role. So it's a cross-functional thing, which I'm super excited about. I think the challenges for me in corporate are not having to use legal and financial as the reasons for why people should do things, and really, really focusing in on, you know, things like your reputation, the public, like the relationship that you have with the public or your clients or your future clients, understanding that you work in symbiosis with the communities that you operate within, and that you just don't kind of take, but you also give back and create opportunities, and understanding that from like a DEI perspective, as well as like a, you know, Canada being this diverse country, wouldn't you want to make sure that your business was future-proof by facilitating opportunities and environments that allowed everyone to be employed, work, benefit from your products and services, you know, not be disappointed by your ads, be able to recommend you. So really, like, that relationship with the public and understanding, like, what does that look like 5-10 years from now, as opposed to like, we have a lawsuit, we have compliance, you know, this is going to cost this much now, but if we do it in like 2 years, maybe it'll even cost this much more, so this is why we're going to do it now.
It's interesting that you mentioned accessibility and as well as DEI in there. And I know there's been a lot of controversial discussions with really smart, reasonable, passionate folks on both sides of the issue of, should accessibility be included in DEI or should it be its own thing? And I'm interested in your take on that.
For me, I will always say that it should be included in there. But I think right now the current environment requires this sort of idea approach where it's inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility, because people don't know how to create that. They don't understand what it looks like. Not everyone has that expertise. And I'm not saying it's acceptable. I just feel like in order for that A to really fold into the D, the E, and the I, there has to be this understanding that accessibility exists within there. And it's not just from a disability perspective, right? It's like literacy, gender, socioeconomic status and access, education, life experiences, age. Those things do play into how, you know, accessibility and disability play out in our real world experiences. But by not considering disability and accessibility in any of those DEI experiences or those knowledge competencies, we automatically just don't include it. And then disability gets completely like removed as a category of an opportunity to create equity, really.
I mean, I'm pushing back because I'm interested in your thoughts. And I think IDEA is a really interesting way to talk about things and way to think about things. But how do we embrace intersectionality in that kind of framework and make space for all of the conversations that need to happen and that we want to happen? The thing I've sort of heard from folks on the other side is that I want accessibility to be separate, because if I show up with a cane or in a wheelchair, that's all anybody ever wants to talk about. And we don't talk about racial issues, or we don't talk about feminist issues, or we don't talk because that's that one piece of someone's identity can be all consuming in some ways. I think it's kind of the primary criticism I've heard of like including accessibility in the DEI space. And so have you thought about that? And how do we build space for all of the conversations that need to happen? Sometimes they feel like they need to happen all at once, right?
Yeah, I totally understand that perspective, because I myself would not want my race to be the thing that's the focus, or my own. I mean, because I have what I know to be as invisible disabilities. I would not want that to be the topic if that was the only thing. And like, that's not my, you know, my lived experience is one thing, is not the experience, and it's not the only experience. I think not wanting the A there from a personal perspective, like I can understand exactly why someone would not want the A there at all, because why would you want that to be the only thing that people talk to you about? But I want to push back and maybe go back to a time where, you know, gender-based analytics was the thing that a lot of places or people were looking at when it came to intersectionality, and people making it really important, because then it was like, well, you know, it starts with gender-based or whatever, right? And it's like, it's an analytic plus framework, and it's a theoretical framework. I mean, yes, it starts with gender because of what's in the name, but it really does force you to look at the intersectionality of these different equity-deserving experiences or lived lives, and looking at, you know, not just someone being impacted, but also someone being able to navigate these different communities or these different experiences without having their disability be even a question about it, right? Like, or understanding that their disability in conjunction with being like a racialized person in my thing, or even my age might be a thing. Understanding, I think that for me, what I'm understanding is people don't understand that they're not in competition. It's almost like if we were to think of someone as like a cake, I hate to put people as like, what object am I today? But like as a cake, right? There's all these ingredients. You are not tasting just the sugar. You are not tasting just the eggs, right? It's like we are these people, everything folded in and mixed in and then baked in together. And there's like so many different types of cakes, so many types of ingredients that can go, different brands that go into things. People are these unique beings that aren't just these one things. And I feel like understanding that the A forces you to only look at this person as like a product of sugar or a dessert rather than a person, right? Or like this one version of cake rather than like a dessert or an or a food option. You know what I'm saying? Like this person is a whole person. And I feel like people want to isolate these issues and not understand how they impact each other, because it can be overwhelming. And there's different histories that compete. Like if we think about, you know, the racialized experience or like lack of education around like who gets to know what about who, access intimacy is also important, right? Like, people don't understand that asking for your needs to be met from an accommodations perspective versus just a, I'm a human being, I require this level of respect. I've been noticing that once you have these kind of really real conversations, people can understand how, you know, accessibility fits into all these categories and why it doesn't need to be on its own. And then at the same time, understanding that not everyone has that maturity model in their organization. Not everyone has that education or awareness around disability and why, depending on who you are and where you're at and where you're working and what communities you operate in, that A might need to stand out for you to understand why you might need to create equity of access. And even if you don't agree with the position, why you understand people around you might need that A to stand out so that they can get their needs met.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And it's I'm loving this because it's, you know, it's a place where reasonable people can disagree. But I love your approach of sort of the right tool for the right time. And I think it's also interesting the way you mentioned competition, in that we kind of see things as a competition. We also sometimes kind of see things as a limited resource competition, right? Like, mm-hmm. if we are creating equity, gender and sexuality, then they're going to take all the resources and we won't create equity for disability, right? Or vice versa. And so sometimes I think people with different needs feel like they're in competition in ways which they aren't, right? How do we get people past that?
I think first figuring out, you know, what is it a money cost thing? Is it a people cost thing? Like, in terms of who gets to sit at what table? Is it like a, you don't want to hear whose perspectives and why? Is it a time thing? Is it a lack of awareness thing? Is it, for me, when I think about resources being limited, I always try and go back to, what are the goals? What resources do we have? Where can we be innovative, right? What do we already know that already exists in the space that we can leverage? I think people are always afraid to ask for help in terms of like, hey, I'm running this event. I don't know how to do this, or I don't know where to look for this, or I'm running this event. These are the goals for the event. I don't know how to get there. Or I have a product I'm working on right now and it needs to be able to do X, Y, Z. But I feel like I've been given these requirements. How do I make sure that these requirements are also met? So ABC, let's just say, for example, I'm being very abstract because I don't want to point to anything specific and maybe create not inclusion in my own discussions. But understanding, like, what is the priority? Is it A, B, or C? And who is the most impacted, right? So if we do A, do we facilitate more access? Or if we choose C over whatever, who gets what? And I think when we think about who gets what, I think we always have to prioritize who's going to, not just like who our targets are, but like, if we were to look back on this in 5 years, would we regret our decisions? What would we need to achieve our goals? And, you know, if we're going to hit the mark, how are we going to make sure that we're going to communicate that we're not going to be able to meet the mark? Because sometimes if you have limited resources, but you communicate what is happening, why, sometimes the people that are going to participate might help you find solutions, right? And then that goes back to asking for help. And then I want to, like, also think about co-design, right? On limited resources, co-design is a very, very powerful framework and tool, because you are literally working with the people that you want to provide the access for or give the opportunities to or have participation from. And who better to know what you need, how you might need it, what has worked in the past, or what they might want to see in the future, than working with the people that you literally want to create for.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love what you said there so much about like transparent communication, because it's something that organizations don't seem to want to do, because there's this like, oh, well, if we say we didn't meet the mark here, like, now we're going to get in trouble, right? And yeah. And nobody wants that. But like, from my own lived experience, if there's like a notice on a website saying that it's not currently accessible with screen readers, at least I'm A, aware that they are aware of screen readers and that they know they have a problem. And B, I'm not going to waste the next hour and a half of my life trying to use this website, right? I'm just going to move on and either ask for help or go elsewhere. So anyway, it's, yeah, that really resonated. Nikki, I think you've been trying to jump in and I keep stepping on you and I apologize.
No, it's totally fine. So I'm really into this co-designing. I love this method. I wrote a blog post about it's important to include people, but I think a lot of people struggle with being able to co-design because they just run into barriers like Where do I find people? What do I do? What are some things that you would tell the people who are like, I really want to co-design, but I don't know how?
I think the first thing is you understand why you want to co-design. Because if you don't know your why, then what are you doing? Is it kind of performative? Is it just so that you can say that this has been co-designed? Is it so that this is your new opportunity? So understanding your why for co-design will help, you know, facilitate your goals for who you want to reach out to. Knowing that co-design is literally every single time I think I've seen it done, it's almost like an innovation, right? Because you just get all these minds at the table, you get all these ideas, and then you get to work, you actually get to work with, let's say, real people, real ideas, real solutions, but nothing that's really in the hypothetical that someone wouldn't have thought of as being a real potential solution, right? You get the collaboration at the very least, you actually get collaboration. But I think the first thing is can you collaborate? Do you want to collaborate? Then when it comes to like reaching out, right? Fable was one of the first places I had ever heard of that facilitated this, but thinking about who you want to collaborate with and why them. Are there organizations that support these types of people? Are there organizations that or communities that you're aware of? If you don't have access to them, do you know people that might? If you don't, Reddit is a wonderful place. Twitter is a wonderful place. LinkedIn is a wonderful place. I always go back to the internet because as a millennial, that's my safe space. But something like, let's just say you're not so comfortable with the internet and you're not so tech savvy. How hard is it for you to go to a library or like call a library or call like a community center, even your city, right? The city has, in Toronto anyways, the city has so many helplines for different things for people to get the support that they need. Social media is wonderful. I know I've seen people post on like certain access or disability groups to recruit people for co-design or for testing. And then looking at other businesses that have done it, right? Like if you're not in competition with a business, but they've done something innovative and they said that they co-designed it, how hard is it for you, the marketing person of X, to go to the marketing person of Y to be like, hey, we want to do this. We saw your awesome campaign. Would you be open to like a coffee chat, or would you be open to like an email, or like, you know, even just messaging somebody, like how, like thinking about just like actually reaching out instead of trying to do everything within, right? Because again, another opportunity for collaboration, but you don't know what you don't know. And by talking to people, you actually learn more.
Yeah, this is amazing. I'm going to get us back. I mean, we're like halfway through the time and we haven't really asked any of the questions.
So much.
I want to pull us back in to like, what are some of the key moments that sort of led you to this place? People, ideas, books, media, events.
I can start with my grandparents. So my grandmother was a person with a limb deference who lived with diabetes, and I think understanding as a child how this woman had lived, like had been like a successful like business person in within her communities, and had modified her like life because of at that time medical support, and just seeing like how much she talked about her life changing as a child, it was so easy to understand, like this person had a whole life that people didn't understand or had no idea about because they only saw her in this one way. And it really made me realize, like at that time, like how hard was it for her to be able to A, tell her grandchild, like I used to be this person, and also being like a child and being like, oh wait, like this is like a real thing that like actually like my grandma can't run her business anymore. Or I mean, this was like in a different country, so there's like different access things. And this was like in the early 90s. But understanding that perspective, like having someone literally share their experience with you, like family member to family member. And then my grandfather as well, he had had hearing loss since he was like 19. So seeing someone who eventually got hearing aids and like had technology completely change like their experience in their life as an entrepreneur, that made a really big difference. And then for me, it was actually just doing things like in Girl Guides, planning events. So Girl Guides of Canada had requirements for accessible events for like camps and stuff in the early 2000s, even before AODA, right? So that was creating equity for participation. In my time at U of T, there was a requirement for any conferences or events to be held at accessible venues. So understanding built environment and marketing and accommodations, like just from a school that understood how important it was to facilitate that for the educational milieu. Like I was really thankful to go to a place that did that. And then my own experiences being diagnosed in my 20s and my 30s with different like disability and neurodiversity, having that self-compassion and understanding that like I operated in a certain way and that there were reasons why I couldn't do certain things or why I couldn't meet certain goals or why I had to now ask for accommodations and understand that I'm just asking for equal participation. I'm not asking for anything that is above and beyond that is being seen a certain way. Hopefully that like shapes like my personal experience. In terms of books, so because I started in the technical space, especially the coding and design space, Inclusive Design by Regine Gilbert, that was one of the first books I ever read. And it totally helped me understand theoretically and also like just example wise how to do digital accessibility from ideation to execution. Laura Kalbeg's Accessibility for Everyone, another book that like has both the process and corporate aspect as well as the technical. Inclusive Design Patterns by Hayden Pickering. I will evangelize that book forever because it is literally the thing that allowed me to test actual components and figure out how to code my own components and give good direction to developers once I kind of got my hands off the developer space. Mismatch by Toombs. That one is really great for practical examples, but like approaches and frameworks and understanding like how innovation is so critical in this space because you can leverage kind of what you know from certain products and experiences and take them elsewhere and reduplicate them. And then from lived experiences, Disability Visibility, which is first person stories from the 21st century by edited by Alice Wong, has plenty of stories that really help me understand, I would say, the perspective of people who I would have never come across in my entire like accessibility disability journey. And it really helped me inform not just my practice, but like my future career is in terms of like what I want to do or where I can take my knowledge or the types of things I want to be researching or looking into when I have downtime. My favorite book to recommend to people is Demystifying Disability by Emily Lado. That one is my favorite because it's so accessible. It's like plain language. It's very practical. And it almost talks to you like no matter what age you are, I feel like you can read this book and walk away learning something. I definitely recommend reading it multiple times, but definitely it's like an easy read, something that you can give as a gift. And I feel like no matter who reads it, you learn something. Like whether you've been in the space for 30 years or you have been recently diagnosed, you're a president of company, there's something in there for everybody. And then events. So I think A11YTO, both the conference and the camp, all those talks have been so phenomenal in terms of like giving me the knowledge and perspectives that I was missing out on and learning from like industry professionals. In terms of Fable being one of the first critical events, I don't remember what it was now. I mean, I remember writing a cover letter about it, but it was in October 2020 when I was working at a company and they had posted like this event. And I don't remember who was at the event, but I remember it was like literally people talking about how from ideation to execution, what does that process look like to do inclusive design? You know, who needs to be aware when, why, how to get people on board in your company, you know, your maturity model, like what does that look like? So for me, that was like one of the biggest things that made me really, really want to get into the space knowing that there were companies that were doing this and not just like advertising for roles, but like didn't know how to execute it. And then the ID24 playlists, those like that conference that comes out every year. I love that. I think I never stop learning from that, but it's something that exists on the internet forever or as long as YouTube is going to be around and they keep that up. That is that playlist that comes out every year or like the conference that gets produced every year is something that I think allows people to continue producing knowledge around this, but also helping people see different perspectives and continue, like, I just think about like continuing education in this space. And this is like one of those free ways to do it that you don't have to pay for a course.
Yeah. What an amazing list. Note to selves. Let's get some links in the show notes.
Yeah. Cause I was like taking notes. I was like, oh my God. Oh my God.
I'm just picturing all the podcast listeners in their cars commuting to work, trying desperately to sort of write this down. Don't do that, folks. We'll get stuff in the show notes.
We will definitely put them in the show notes.
Yes, be safe out there. But you know, saying that, I gotta say, I love Laura and Hayden and their work. You know, ALITO, ID24. I feel like we're hanging out in the same spaces. Is it just me, or did Alice Wong edit an anthology of disability and science fiction, or am I thinking of someone else?
I probably need to keep up with my like lived experience books. I feel like I keep going back to the theoretical. Like I didn't give another set of books, which was the Ryerson Press books, or I guess the TNU books now, the Toronto Metropolitan University books.
Yep.
Have been phenomenally helpful as well. And I think anybody who's thinking to get into space, they give you the business case, they have code, they have everything beginning to end. But like, I really wish I need to like look, maybe I can go look it up afterwards. I don't.
Yeah, I'm sitting here wondering if I'm maybe thinking of someone else, because there we do have so many great folks working and thinking and talking in this space. Did you say you went to OCAD?
No, I went to University of Toronto, but I would love to go to OCAD's Inclusive Design Program or their Strategic Foresight Program. Those are like future goals of mine.
Sweet. Yeah. Sorry, as we talk Canadian baseball here. Before we continue this conversation, it's time to pause for just a minute for a word from our sponsor.
Hello, my name is Noah. I'm a full-time voice control user. I'm a member of Fable's community of accessibility testers. If you're listening to this podcast, you already know just how important it is to integrate the voices of people with disabilities into every aspect of your product development journey. Fable can help you do that, from improving your team's accessibility training with Fable Upskill to working directly with assistive technology users with Fable Engage. We can help you take the next step in building amazing websites and apps that are accessible and easy to use for everyone. To learn more, check out what we do at makeitfable.com and follow us on LinkedIn and Twitter.
And we're back.
I feel like you answered a lot of the questions that we sort of had. And so what I'm really curious about is like, what are some of the outcomes you experienced while exploring and talking about disability? Has like the space opened up as you've started to be more open about disability?
For me, I think once I was ready to come to terms with the fact that I had been diagnosed with a disability, and now I was no longer just someone who was planning events and trying to create access that way, because I knew about the importance of it from like, you know, the 360 perspective around, you know, the GBA analytics, making sure things are like financially affordable, making sure that people can actually participate. I really understood, for me, like, I'm not going to take this as an opportunity to lean back. I'm going to take this as an opportunity now to change any ableism I've kind of put out there without realizing it, and like advocate from my own voice, like from my own genuine voice and my own experiences. And I think it allowed me to like listen in better, if that makes sense, because not because voices weren't important before, but because I could fully understand what that experience was like without even realizing I had been experiencing it all along. So in terms of outcomes like self-compassion, empathy, helping other people understand that is part of the journey, and that sympathy, there is no space for sympathy here. We are not asking for that. No one wants that. And if you come to us with that and you are not received well, that is because you do not have the best intentions. And that I don't want to say that like truly, but like you're not really looking at it from the lens of wanting to change things. It's more of like, I don't want to go back to like the disability models, but really like the medical model or the charity model. I really try and help people understand like why those views are problematic. But in terms of like outcomes, for me, it's like understanding the variety of perspective, how people approach it and how to change their minds. I really hate to say, but change their minds. But like, really, I know that you are an evangelist, Sam. So I try not to use that word, but I really do believe like winning hearts, changing minds, getting them over to the good side.
Yeah. I absolutely hear you about kind of the freighted and weighted problems with the word evangelist. I use it because I work basically entirely on the corporate side where titles matter, right? Like for my own career advancement, I have to have the same title as all of the other people who do the thing that I do. So I really do in a very real way feel that I don't necessarily have the choice of title, just because you're in that corporate kind of hierarchical world and you have to sometimes to make the change that you want to see, you have to dance the dance. So, I mean, I love what I do, but I hear your hesitancy through evangelism.
I think for me, the outcomes is like not because of the diversity of perspectives, but the ongoing education. I think for me, the biggest thing is that people actually care and want to change things. Mm-hmm. They're not interested in upholding these old models of, you know, institutionalization and segregation. People really understand the importance of integration, awareness, where they're sitting at, where their gaps are. And I think that's just been super fruitful, because when you have these different people, different places in different areas of the getting to the accessibility or inclusive design spectrum, you see these sort of chains of support, networks of support, where people are connecting, understanding that, you know, they might have the goals of one company, but they only have the resources of the company that they are at. So it's like, what does it look like to do it at our level? Or, you know, there are places that are like, okay, we really got this goal down, but we want to be like the, you know, I don't want to say like any one business, but like the whatever business, or like the head of whatever, or like the leader in this. So it's like, what does it look like to scale and get there? What else can we be doing differently? And seeing people, like, I think for me, the outcomes is like seeing the change, even if it's slow at times or it's not always what we expect. The fact that there is a desire to change and facilitate and create equitable access, and understanding why that's important from a non-charity model, non-medical model. Like, that's what I think I wanted to say maybe earlier, but I couldn't quite articulate.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you talk so much about changing hearts and changing minds and educating and all of this stuff. And it really calls out to earlier in the discussion, you brought up your experiences with the Girl Guides and with U of T. And we talk a lot about shifting left in accessibility in like web development in all this stuff and getting the voices of the community involved early. But I wonder if maybe we don't talk enough about shifting left in people's personal journeys, as in making sure they're taught about these things in high school, in university, in college, before their career starts, instead of suddenly being at a job and now accessibility like lands on your desk as a thing that you have to do. But how do we make movement there, and how do we get early accessibility and disability education that is effective and that does the thing is something I wonder about. You seem like someone who's done thinking about similar things.
So I want to talk about this a lot because it's something I've been obsessed about for the last year in my career. And I think it came from doing this sort of DEI project at Canada Post, where I was looking at what does it look like to put a DEI page together for this organization, but what are best practices in the space? And it really came down to like, what does it look like from the internal? And then I kept coming back to this issue of like education or people not being aware of it. So I have thought about this in multiple ways, and I think it comes back to curriculum design and understanding like the goals of the people in power at that time, or your political parties, or whoever is responsible for education, what their goals are for the next 10, 20 years of Canadians, right? And not just from like an education perspective, but from an employment perspective, from an economic and community participation perspective, like ledger, economic and employment opportunity, like kind of like what does it look like to live with a disability and participate equally, and why is that important? So I think unless that's kind of like a concern for the people who are designing curriculum at the time, it just doesn't come across. But in terms of really, really practical ways, I've thought about, if we think about how we educate in Ontario anyways, students around Indigenous and First Nations, Métis, their history, what does that look like from like a grade 1 through grade 12 perspective? There's multiple opportunities in the curriculum to do that, right? And there's different modalities through which you do that, right? Whether it's like reading a novel, you're doing a history lesson, you might be doing it in social sciences. And then now looking at that as, or if we think about like the history of Black Canadians, you know, histories of slavery, segregation, if we think about immigrants, how immigrants have been treated, like that, I remember in grade 10 history, we had a unit on that. So having those like equity deserving people be part of the curriculum, their histories, looking at what has happened in Canada's history, we can do the same thing with people with disabilities, or inclusive design and access, and understanding that in grade, like, let's, I don't know when people learn PowerPoint and Word now. Back in my day, we did like Corel Word Perfect. So I don't know when these students are learning these technologies, but I think that like starting, you know, teaching them how to structure their documents or like being able to use the different tools, what things like headings are, color contrast. Whenever they start to learn these softwares, that's one place to start. So I remember in grade six, we started learning PowerPoint and Word in grade six for writing these like 5-paragraph essays or putting together PowerPoint presentations. That would have been a perfect opportunity to teach us a little bit about, you know, color, design, you know, why we wouldn't want to use animations, or if we do use animations, how else can we talk about what's happening on the screen? I think really from a practical perspective, when you first show a movie in class, you know, when you have that opportunity to either watch an educational movie, I remember back in my day, it was like Bill Nye the Science Guy, right? Asking, do people need captions? Or saying, we're going to have the captions on because some people read better, and just educating around that. I think about grade 10 history, you know, the history of Canada, having a unit of the history of people with disabilities. What does that look like? You know, the inception of Canada, or what does it look like from the Indigenous perspective to post-colonization? I think about grade 8 geography, right? I remember learning about social geography and like how people plan to live where they do, what things are important to them, thinking about built environment being a very important part of that. That's a greater opportunity to integrate that. So I thought about it from a really practical perspective and kind of where it might fit into the Ontario curriculum. But I really do agree with Sam in that there has to be a way for the curriculum or the people who design curriculum to understand why we need to change curriculum, because those outcomes impact how people live and operate, employ, work in the world, and how they include people and how they not include people, or how they design experiences and the sort of biases that are encoded that they're going to have to challenge now as adults, rather than understanding it from a children's perspective where you have like 12 years to rewrite how you might view something.
And it's also really interesting to me that you talk so much about history, about the history of colonization, about the history of Native and Métis and Indigenous folks. And in some ways, I think maybe one of the problems that we're also struggling with, and I think about this a lot, and I've mentioned it, I think, on other episodes of this podcast, is the erasure of our history as a group of people with disabilities, right? Because it's only recently that we've really even recognized it as an identity as opposed to a medical condition. Right. And like, you can find, I don't know, on YouTube, like 4-hour documentaries about the design and construction of a gaming console that was released in 1980 and only ever sold 10, right? But like, you can find almost nothing about the first magnifier, about the first screen reader from a Canadian perspective, right? How our thinking about disability has changed culturally and legally pre-colonization and post-colonization and French versus English and all this stuff. And it feels like there is a lot of group knowledge that has been lost or destroyed, because sometimes it feels like only in the past 30 years have we even recognized ourselves as a group that has contiguous history and knowledge. And sometimes it's a depressing thought, because like, how do we overcome that, right? Like, the history's already happened.
Yeah. I think first actually documenting it somewhere and looking for it in places. Like, during my master's, I did it in South Asian studies and religion. There were didactic stories that had people with disabilities. And I mean, there were certain things that were tropey, but like the lack of like community that would have existed there, but really putting people, I would say, on pedestals, or like, you know, treating them for the other gifts that they had. At least I think about just like there not being disability erasure in those stories being super important to like me being able to always bring this sort of like historical perspective to it, like understanding that people have existed since the beginning of time with disabilities, and that like they do get woven into stories depending on how that plays out. That also changes how people perceive and how people learn about disability. But I wonder if there is an opportunity in both literature, things like history of science, just history in general, other disciplines like psychology, sociology, anthropology, to take on disability and accessibility as communities of not just practice, but like of identities that have existed for a long time and that maybe have been not included because the people who end up writing history are not necessarily people with disabilities, or they don't want to include them because they don't, you know, they don't see certain things as personhood, or it's not part of, we think about just like, you know, the history of Canada where there was segregation and institutionalization, You didn't experience mm-hmm. that person in your world. How are you going to write about them? How are you going to be aware of them? Mm-hmm. And that sucks because that's the erasure part that, like, unfortunately, I'm trying to be very careful with what I say here because of where I work. But certain institutions have put forth and unfortunately created those experiences, histories that have been obliterated or completely not included.
But we also have the trouble with group identity and with changing of understanding, right? Like if we think about famous figures in the past, often because of the state of the culture or the state of understanding, people would either not identify as people with disabilities or would not have been diagnosed as people with disabilities. And yet they would have been. I feel like this is something that the gender and sexuality community struggles with a lot, right? Like assigning a particular sexual orientation to someone in history based on circumstantial evidence, because it's important to have that group narrative. And I think we sometimes run into the same thing as people with disabilities, right? I bet a lot of the most famous scientists probably were affected by autism, but like for us in 2022 to like go back and make that determination feels uncomfortable. And it feels like there's a lot of maybe disability identity that's wrapped up in things like that as well.
I think there's the people don't want to challenge their perspectives because then it would challenge a bunch of other things. And that makes people feel uncomfortable, unfortunately. I'm not saying it's acceptable, but I realize that not challenging these narratives is exactly what makes it seem like we've only existed for the past 30 years, right? Or like we are only now a group or an identity of the past 30 years or 50 years or wherever. I remember learning about like Martha's Vineyard in linguistics and like understanding like the sign language community that existed there, right? And if it was not for my linguistics class, my historical linguistics class, I would not have known about sign language existing before like history of Canada, like no idea. So I really think people have to be comfortable to both have their narratives and their ideas challenged, but then people also have to be really open to challenging these narratives or these identities and understanding that, like, because we only have so many, you know, traits or whatever to identify with, like, it's okay to claim them as like part of the community or recognize that they might have been, and that's perfectly acceptable. Like, disability is not a dirty word. Why are you like, what are you telling me when you don't want to do that? Like, when you don't want to have that uncomfortable conversation or that conversation that might challenge your whole worldview? Like, what are you holding, or what is it that you, what power are you holding on to by not doing that? And why is there no power in you changing your mind and you being able to understand something through a completely different lens?
Yeah, that's super interesting. My gut reaction is that I don't want to misrepresent or misidentify people, but also they are no longer with us. Yeah, I don't know. It's an interesting balancing line. Yeah, but regardless, we've got like 8 minutes left, so I had better turn it over to Nikki to do what she does best and bring us back on track from these amazing tangents that we've been privileged to go on together.
Well, we have three questions, and I am really curious about what have you discovered that sort of like surprised you along this journey.
For me, it's all the people that I have got support from. Like, I've reached out to so many people around mentorship, just questions here or there. People who are not necessarily people with disabilities, but people who have worked in the environment for like such a long time, the industries for such a long time, that are have no problem like giving me support and helping me with like career questions or like how to approach something, or like, am I using the right resources, or am I missing anything? I really thought that, you know, if I'm going to say that I'm something like a digital accessibility specialist or an inclusive design person, that I would be expected to always deliver 100% and always know. And I just realized that like people are so welcoming and inclusive. Just like I come and show up in the community, like they are as amazing as I want them to be, but that as also as I aspire to show up as. For me, lived experience is something that is so underrated. I think that that is like the biggest underrated thing I've ever experienced, like in the whole community. Like, people don't realize that lived experience is where it's at. And by talking to people, listening, actually including these experiences, not just through like co-design, but like participatory culture, just even choosing to open up your mind, you have an opportunity to change the way you approach things completely, because you took someone's lived experience and not just a textbook you know, case of XYZ, or, you know, this is coded like this because this is how it's always been. So I think for me, those are the two, like, fact that the community is as amazing as people say that it is, but that I experienced that myself. And then, you know, lived experience being this really, really missed opportunity that people don't realize the value of.
That makes a lot of sense. So if people wanted to, like, start, what are some small ways people could move on that path towards inclusion, access, and, like, furthering the rights of people with disabilities?
I think figuring out where your comfort level is with disability first, like, actually questioning yourself where you're at with it. Because, I mean, I feel like I've come, like, a long way in my own journey, but I know areas that I could be exploring or thinking about, but if you're not comfortable with exploring it, then you need to first question why and what about it makes you feel uncomfortable. And really looking at, like, what are your ideas around accessibility, disability, like, what power are you holding on to? I think the next opportunity is, depending on where you're at in your journey, what are you interested in changing, right? Or what are you looking to learn about? Or what are you looking to participate in? And there's, you know, podcasts, books, blogs, you know, websites, like YouTube videos, like, so much media. There's people. I think talking to people about it is really important too. So if you're questioning yourself, being comfortable and vulnerable enough to, and safe, also making sure that you are coming from a safe space so that you can hold capacity for people to have these conversations, because not everyone wants to discuss their disability and not everyone feels comfortable questioning themselves. So having the right people to do that with, but not being afraid to do that, is going to get you far, because that allows you to have these dialogues and learn from people, but also maybe share with people your knowledge. I think something else is understanding, like, the history of people with disabilities, the legal landscape. What does it look like in your country or where you're at? How were you raised? You know, what would you like to change? Why do you want to change it? Why is it important to you? I know these are, like, very, very basic questions, and they, like, require a lot of introspection. But I feel like if you don't know where to start, starting with yourself is, like, the safest space, because it's just you, right? You're being safe with you. You're being real with you. You can Google anything on incognito if you need to.
It sounds kind of similar in some ways. I don't know if you're familiar with kind of finding your why, kind of the Simon Sinek kind of deal. It seems like that's applicable outside of marketing, right? And applicable in this too, because if you don't know why you are doing this, then it's hard to be either a good advocate as a person with a disability or a good ally, because the vision isn't clear. But, you know, this has been an incredible conversation that has given me new thoughts and challenged me. And so thanks so much for being here and for participating in it. And before we close, if folks want to find you and keep up with your work and what you're doing and keep the conversation going, where's the best place to find you? And is there anything you want to promote?
So first, I would say my Twitter, InclusionRatedE. I haven't been tweeting or doing very much social media for the last little while. I've just been really focused on actually getting work out at work and figuring out what I want to kind of do next in terms of, like, the inclusive design space, or, like, where I see myself fitting in. Angie Rajani. I think I have my, like, name has, like, the CPAC beside it. And then in terms of people or things I want to promote, obviously I want to promote, you know, people understanding that you don't have to be perfect to do this, or you don't have to know everything, but you should start. But specific people. So I actually really want to thank any mentors in my life or people who have given me opportunities to participate in the space. From Fable specifically, Kate and Perry. From my career, so Kim Blatt, Juliana Rosal, Levy Chandra Shaker, David Forney, who is my boss at Canada Post, the ACAT committee at the TTC, who gave me the best experience doing accessibility UX research and helping me prototype and test web pages that really kicked my career off. And then Sidra Mahmood, who gave me my first opportunity to enter the space and gave me the mentorship I needed to apply for my first role. These people, I am so thankful for their participation in my career and their support. Without them, I would not be where I am, and I would cry. I would cry right now, but it's a podcast, so let's not. I'm just very grateful that I get to hold this seat because of them.
Yeah. But how have you and I not had a conversation yet? I feel like we're in the same space. I get to work with Kate and Perry all day. It's as great as you think it would be. Oh,
I need to reach out to you probably. It's funny. It's like I look at everyone as like these titans of industry and I'm so afraid to approach them. But that once I start talking to them, they're like my mentors or my people. And I'm like, I have no problem going back to them. Like, why am I so shy?
Right. I'm the same way. It's like starting a conversation is hard, but then once you're there, it's great. Anyway, as we do draw things to a close, final thought, I guess, is there anything that you wanted to talk about or tell us or say that we didn't ask you?
No, I so appreciate you giving me this space, Nikki and Sam. I am so thankful that you gave me this opportunity, and I really hope anyone that's listening to this, 3 years ago, I was not in the digital accessibility space, but I started having the experience, and if you want to enter it, there is always room. Just reach out to somebody.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. This was so wonderful. I learned about so many different books that some I knew, some I am just going to like pick up. Being dyslexic, I have to make sure that there's audio books so that it's inclusive to me, but that's been a big barrier for me. But I'm sure I'll figure it out. This has been so lovely. And thank you again so much for sharing and opening up.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us and for your time and for the conversation. And really, really looking forward to moving forward in accessibility as in through the rest of the year and working together.
Thank you so much again for this conversation.
Thanks for listening to Disability Bandwidth. If you like this episode of Disability Bandwidth, please subscribe and share it with friends and family. Today's episode was hosted by Sam Peru and Nikki Nolan, edited by Nikki Nolan. Transcripts are written by Emma Klauber. The theme music is created by F.A. Achman. Special thanks to everyone at Fable, who, without their support, this show would not be possible. You can find out more about Disability Bandwidth on Twitter and Instagram at Disability Bandwidth, or on our website, disabilitybandwidth.com. Thanks for listening.